Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The country's top energy official visits Pittsburgh.
This facility is, I was commenting earlier, I think it's a part of seeing the future.
Veterans find gardening therapeutic.
Purpose. I have purpose again.
We visit with Appalachian blogger and podcaster Dave Tabler.
For some reason, we've gotten off track and forgotten that Appalachian history is American history.
And take a tour of a historic home in Hinton, West Virginia.
As a group of local citizens who thought that it was worthwhile to save the oldest house in Hinton, we began our process of trying to keep it running and operating.
These stories and more coming up this week on Inside Appalachia. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. A retired coal miner who suffers from black lung disease has urged Congress to help clear a backlog of claims for fellow miners who have the disease. Princeton, West Virginia native Robert Bailey testified at the U.S. Senate Subcommittee on Employment and Workplace. The hearing focused on the struggles miners face while seeking black lung benefits. As West Virginia Public Radio's Jessica Lilly reports, lawmakers say the testimony on Capitol Hill was meant to do three things.
The first reason for the subcommittee's hearing was to highlight the struggles that black lung claimants face while seeking benefits. Testimony referenced an investigation by the Center for Public Integrity that revealed some cutthroat methods by coal industry doctors and lawyers. Those methods helped defeat and delay benefit claims from the growing number of miners suffering from black lung and their widows. The second, to review the actions taken by the Department of Labor to help improve the situation for miners. Panelists testified the DOE has instructed reviewers to assist those miners without counsel and help them keep records up to date in order to streamline the process. The third, to discuss a growing number of backlogs at the DOL. Senator Rockefeller and Manchin, along with other members of Congress, are working on a bill that would address some of the systematic problems in the black lung system by expanding a miner's access to medical evidence, create a program to help miners secure legal representation when applying for benefits, and make grant funding available for research into the disease. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Athens.
Scientists and elected officials gathered in Harrodsburg, Kentucky this past week to cut the ribbon on a new carbon capture pilot project. As Kentucky Public Radio's Erica Peterson reports, the project was developed by scientists at the University of Kentucky's Center for Applied Energy Research and is being installed at Kentucky Utilities' E.W. Brown Power Plant.
First, some basics. Carbon capture refers to processes that remove carbon dioxide from power plant emissions. Usually, it's used in conjunction with coal-fired power plants, because burning coal releases more carbon dioxide than other fossil fuels, like natural gas. And scientists have an interest in trying to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide released into the atmosphere, because the gas is contributing to climate change. But the technology is still prohibitively expensive for power plants, and energy-intensive to use. Michael Matuszewski of the National Energy Technology Laboratory says this new project at Harrodsburg addresses that problem in unique ways.
What we're really trying to show is that the capture system and the power plant can play together.
Matuszewski says the new carbon capture system actually improves the plant's efficiency while it captures the carbon dioxide. The small-scale project cost about $20 million. $15 million of that is from the Federal Department of Energy. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Erica Peterson.
West Virginia and other Appalachian coal-producing states can actually thrive under new U.S. environmental protection regulations that aim to reduce greenhouse gases, at least according to three panelists participating in a recent public forum. West Virginia Public Radio's Liz McCormick has more on the forum, which took place in Shepherdstown.
West Virginia must cut back its carbon emission rate by 20% by the year 2030 under the EPA regulations. The panelists leading the forum entitled EPA Carbon Rules, How Can West Virginia Lead, voiced confidence that the state can meet that goal and create jobs as well. The West Virginia chapter of the Sierra Club organized the event. Jefferson County resident Mary Ann Hitt is director of the organization's Beyond Coal campaign.
There is a lot of misinformation out there about this rule and what it requires of coal or gas or in energy efficiency. And the fact of the matter is, here in West Virginia, we can meet the standard through energy efficiency, through wind and solar, through clean energy that's going to provide a lot of new jobs in the state. And it's a really exciting opportunity. We all know that we're struggling with low employment here in West Virginia, and we need more economic opportunity, and this is a great way to bring it to the state.
Aside from HIT, two other panelists seemed to get the most reaction from the audience. One was David Levine, who is a leader in the West Virginia solar industry. Levine is founder and CEO of the company Geostellar Solar, which is based in Martinsburg.
This regulation is not job-killing regulation. It really is going to spur a whole new energy economy, which is really good for consumers in that it's actually going to lower their utility bills, and it's going to spur jobs because solar creates many more jobs per megawatt than big centralized nuclear power plants or coal plants or natural gas power plants.
Levine says that the installation process is frighteningly simple.
Our business is a solar energy marketplace, and the idea is we match people who want to go solar with the right solutions. We tell you exactly how much energy you can produce on your particular rooftop, and then the value of that energy based on the energy you'll displace. So if I used to have a monthly energy bill of $120 a month, it says your new total electricity cost with your solar plus what you'll still be paying the utility company for reduced usage might be down to $80 a month.
Levine says once Geostellar Solar does a site assessment of your home, it takes a licensed contractor about a day to install the panels. But if it's so easy, why aren't more people taking advantage of it?
The reason people aren't going solar today is because they don't have role models. It's like the movement from the horseless carriage to the automobile. You know, cars were foreign. It was like, how can this possibly move without this horse? It's going to be the same thing at some point. People aren't going to talk about solar energy. It's just going to be energy.
Marketing consultant and Jefferson County resident Sean O'Leary says the numbers involving jobs in coal just don't add up.
From the time West Virginia hit its peak in employment in 1940 with about 130,000 jobs, we have dropped down to only about 19,000 jobs now. But in the meantime, the extraction of coal has actually increased. The bottom line is that employment in the coal industry has not ever, at least since 1929, been driven by the volume of coal that's being extracted. And so consequently, when politicians say that by defending the industry and helping to increase the use of coal, they're defending West Virginia jobs, it simply isn't true.
The conversation about how the new EPA regulations will impact the country will continue at a public hearing in Washington, D.C. on July 29th. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Liz McCormick in Shepherdstown.
Meanwhile, energy infrastructure, efficiency, and the role of natural gas in fighting climate change was on the mind of President Obama's top energy official, who spoke in Pittsburgh this past week. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz toured the city as his department heard public comments on its roadmap for America's energy future. Among Moniz's stops was a tour of PNC Bank's so-called green skyscraper under construction. The Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier reports.
When it comes to energy policy, Ernest Moniz is an all-of-the-above kind of guy. So when he came to Pittsburgh, he made sure to tour a building that displayed one of those all-of-the-aboves. Emphasis on above. At PNC Bank's super-efficient office tower rising above downtown Pittsburgh, Moniz took an elevator straight to the top of the building, the 33rd floor. At the top, with iron workers clanging away, Moniz quizzed the bank's energy manager, Nana Wilberforce, about the building.
So those are your principal kind of technologies?
Exactly.
The chimney and the double wall?
When it's opened, a sophisticated ventilation system will help cut energy use almost in half. And lots of windows mean very little lighting will be needed during the day at the building.
Does that mean you think you need lights only 10% of the time?
We actually need light 10% of the time because most of the time light comes into the building. We've positioned it in such a way that
Moniz likes to dig into the numbers of energy efficiency or any other part of the energy puzzle. He's a physicist from MIT. A few floors below, Moniz said he liked coming to see projects like this one.
This facility is, I was commenting earlier, I think it's part of seeing the future, which is what I like to do in my job in various kinds of energy applications.
Buildings account for 40% of overall energy use and 70% of electricity, he said. And as President Obama's point man on energy, Moniz said the project embodied what the country needs to do more of in the future.
What we can do on the demand side to reduce energy intensity, energy requirements, is one of the biggest tools that we've got to combat climate change, to combat pollution, but also to save some money.
Moniz was in Pittsburgh as part of a national tour to discuss energy. It's part of the president's climate action plan. The department is conducting a review as part of its energy roadmap. The review will spell out what it has to do not only to curb climate-damaging emissions, but also provide the country with a steady supply of energy. Pittsburgh was the choice for Moniz to attend in person because of its prominence as a natural gas hub. Gas production has surged in the region, leading to its increasing use in electricity generation. Moniz says that's a good thing for climate change.
We've always talked about gas as being very important in the transition from where we are today to a very low carbon economy of the future.
That's because gas has taken the place of coal, which produces higher amounts of carbon dioxide. But natural gas, when it leaks, is a powerful greenhouse gas in itself. So Moniz said reining in those leaks is key.
So we're working very hard on that, you know. Love to get to kind of like, you know, the holy grail would be like to get to 1% of methane emissions end to end.
The EPA currently estimates that about 1.5% of natural gas leaks out before it reaches its end user. Moniz will be holding other visits around the country this year. His next stop will be in another drilling hot zone. Next month, he goes to Bismarck, North Dakota. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
The Allegheny Front is produced in Pittsburgh and reports on Pennsylvania's environment. More at alleghenyfront.org. Up next inside Appalachia, veterans are finding that farming is more than just a job. You're inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The recent controversy at the VA hospitals where veterans had long wait times before being seen is just one issue the country is dealing with as it struggles to help those returning from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. One fledgling program in West Virginia isn't wasting any time tackling the issues vets face. From transitional job training to psychological therapy, members of the Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program say they're discovering that they can help West Virginia veterans in more ways than they ever anticipated. West Virginia Public Radio's Ashton Mara reports.
In the basement of the Agriculture Commissioner's building in Guthrie, West Virginia, seven military veterans sit in beat-up blue and yellow chairs. They share stories, tips, and jokes. The Marines poking fun at the Army vets that couldn't have made it in their ranks. The Navy vet who laughs but never touts her own accomplishments. The rowdy bunch has gathered, as they often do, to not just spend time surrounded by friends, but to talk about an initiative that's growing more quickly than they were ready for.
Have you ever heard the phrase, hit the floor running? Yeah, that was us. We hit the floor sprinting.
Beth Ann Earle is a Navy veteran and a state contractor, helping to run the Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program. As far back as 2009, James McCormick says he had this idea. McCormick had retired from the Army. Suffering from PTSD, multiple gunshot wounds, and a traumatic brain injury, he found comfort in farming. Earl had done the same, planting her own urban farm in Huntington's West End and growing it into the full-scale business it is today. The two, along with other veterans sitting around the table in Guthrie that night, thought, if this is therapeutic for us, why can't it help others? Last year, McCormick says they began securing up legislative support, shaking hands with lawmakers not as lobbyists, but as constituents, asking their representatives to support their program. McCormick now heads the Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program in the state, which averages about 7 to 10 applicants a week.
We started to get overwhelmed.
Overwhelmed by applicants and by interest, some in row crops, others in livestock, but most of that interest, to McCormick's surprise, was in beekeeping.
This thing is growing, I think, a lot faster than what anybody realizes, and we really found that out when we had to go out and locate the bees. The bees were very hard to find.
McCormick was able to connect with a disabled veteran in the Eastern Panhandle who now builds their beehives, and a beekeeper in Wayne County to help supply bees. Each veteran is provided two hives, the necessary tools, and a protective suit, totaling between $500 and $600. The bees themselves, though, the veterans have to invest in. But when the program was legislatively approved, there was no money attached.
It's kind of been a struggle, being that we have, you know, all these participants, all these veterans that are wanting to come on board and to get this training and develop these programs and develop, you know, a future for themselves.
The program has teamed up with the Department of Veterans Assistance to qualify for state aid in retraining veterans to get them back into the workforce. They've also received grants locally and through universities and have partnered with the West Virginia Women's Commission for funding as well. In the future, McCormick hopes funding won't be a problem. The group plans to ask lawmakers for financial support, but McCormick also says the program is intended to work on a pay-it-forward basis. This year, they provided around 40 veterans with beehives. Next year, those veterans will help a new group by providing them bees and training, helping to perpetuate the program, but also perpetuate the feeling of family they're trying to promote. But it's not just about family for Earl. It's not just about making a living or a few extra bucks either. The Huntington farmer says farming is her therapy.
Reaching into the ground, planting a seed, nurturing it, watching it grow, you know, harvesting it, you know, feeding it to your family. I mean, there's something about the entire evolution that is, it's profound, and it's healing, and it's peaceful. And I think that it helps a lot of us deal with our demons.
This new Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program was created by the West Virginia legislature earlier this year with a goal of helping the state's veterans get back into the workforce in a way that can also be therapeutic, and it has grown exponentially since. Continuing her report, Ashton Mara introduces us to one veteran who says the program has given him a second chance at a normal life.
Here, sing your Frozen song.
Let it go, let it go.
Eric Grandin is the owner and operator of Sugar Bottom Farm in Clay County. I met him and his four-year-old daughter for lunch at one of those small-town diners where everything is homemade.
You want carrots and corn?
Grandin is a disabled Army veteran, serving for 20 years on 6 tours of duty. He suffers from PTSD and was deemed unemployable by the federal government after a flashback in 2011.
I was dealing with a lot of pain, and it sent me back to my days at Desert Storm.
As a patient in the hospital, Grandin says you couldn't make him believe that 20 years had already passed and he was no longer in a war zone.
And another therapist came in. She asked me what I was doing. And basically, I was standing at the wall and just working with my hands, and I told her I was doing the mission board, which is what I did. I worked operations also.
Grandin had multiple responsibilities during his military career, but part of it was to interrogate prisoners of war. He says he did not torture POWs, but used some severe techniques, like preventing them from sleeping for long periods of time. When he retired from the Army in 2009, he showed no signs of mental distress to his family. Grandin says he hid it until that incident, until his life changed. After 2 years of being hospitalized on and off and receiving therapy through the VA, Grandin was introduced to James McCormick, an Army vet himself. McCormick was awarded the Purple Heart multiple times, also suffered from PTSD, and was starting a movement that today is the West Virginia Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program. Grandin got involved in the program early on.
You know, he showed me that there was something else. you know, and that's what the second chance was.
Since, Grandin has turned his family garden into a profitable farm, selling at area farmers markets and even to the State Department of Education for their farm-to-school program. But more than that, Grandin says farming and beekeeping have become his therapy. He no longer needs to see a doctor. Beth Ann Earle, a Navy vet who helps run the Warriors and Veterans to Agriculture program, says that's the experience a lot of their participants are having, finding solace in an unsuspected place.
I actually had a veteran say to me he'd been homeless. He'd been an alcoholic. He'd been drinking and whatnot. Trying to recover, trying to reestablish, failing time after time. And it wasn't until he went to a farm, he went to a retreat, he went somewhere, and he went out and he was working, planting and cleaning a garden. And he says when he picked up the dirt and he rubbed it all over his hands and arms, he says it wasn't until then that the blood came off his hands.
Earl says that was a powerful moment for her. It showed her just what this program could do. But why? Why is farming, beekeeping, raising livestock, why are they such therapeutic endeavors for these veterans? I posed the question to Grandin.
Purpose. I have purpose again.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Ashton Mara in Charleston.
Agriculture is also the centerpiece for an effort in Charleston, West Virginia that aims to help feed the city's hungry. 81-year-old Tom Tolliver is creating community gardens on vacant lots in the city's West End and giving the food grown there to people in need. Volunteers, including at-risk youth, have helped at times, but for about 5 years, Tolliver has been creating these neighborhood gardens mostly all by himself. But recently, new volunteers have begun to join him, and just this past week, a group of 22 11- to 14-year-olds from the YMCA have been working with Tolliver to help bring fresh vegetables to a local shelter. West Virginia Public Radio's Roxy Todd reports.
One of the most heartbreaking things Tom Tolliver says he's ever seen in the alleys of Charleston on multiple occasions, it's families with young children searching for food out of dumpsters.
Nothing hurts me anymore to go into countries and see kids, even in America, eating out of garbage can when it's so simple to grow food.
Not one to remain idle, Tolliver wanted to do something. Today, the first of his community gardens is flourishing in what looks like an unlikely place. There's a lumber mill across the street, a busy road without any sidewalks, and the garden itself is nudged in between a pawn shop and a DeWalt tool center. Along 6th Street, a mom and her two kids walk by carrying groceries from the nearby Family Dollar. Tom also lives down the street. He believes that putting gardens in urban areas like Charleston's West Side helps reduce crime and revitalize the neighborhood.
When you begin to bring in some good, the bad will eventually creep out.
At the Union Mission, where Tolliver has been donating fresh vegetables, the president and CEO, Rex Whiteman, says hunger is on the rise throughout the state and in Appalachia.
Yes, we see people that are hungry, people that have not eaten for several days, and that will come in our doors saying, "Can you help me?" And that is overwhelming in a society and world that of abundance, that we have people that are literally starving to death. With the mines closing down and many of them closing in recent months, that's just created a new wave of hunger and new people that are in the pipeline, as it were, asking for help.
And these new people asking for help mean that new food is needed all the time. Healthy food, like the type of produce Tolliver has been growing in his garden. And this week, the YMCA was inspired by Tolliver's vision and sent 22 kids from summer camp to help him harvest vegetables and deliver them to the Union Mission. But first, there was another job to tackle. One of Tolliver's gardens was about to become overwhelmed by squash bugs.
We're drowning the bugs and we're collecting and harvesting all the beans and the plants that are ready to be harvested.
Hannah McCune is 11 years old, and she's dressed in a brightly painted handkerchief, green socks, and pink tennis shoes. She's also wearing garden gloves for what is sometimes a dirty job, finding and killing squash bugs. It's not a pretty job, but it's a necessary one, because the volunteer gardeners are committed to using no pesticides on the food they grow. Stephanie Highsmith is the master gardener supervising the volunteers. She's had experience with squash bugs and cabbage beetles, which can devastate vegetable gardens if ignored.
Last year, I started with my zucchini going out and looking under the leaves, and I discovered these eggs that were growing underneath the leaves.
Here, is that one?
That's a squash bug. That's a nymph. I'm glad you spotted that.
High Smith is one of the volunteers most involved with Tolliver's Gardens this year. Today, she's teaching the children from the YMCA about the various plants that grow throughout the garden. One of the children asks her,
what do you do to the plants in the winter?
Well, in the wintertime, everything goes dormant. And these are called annuals because they bloom once and then they die. And then we save the seed. You can save the seed from the fruit and grow the same plant next year.
Excitement soon erupts nearby when a blue-tailed skink emerges from one of the raised beds and dives back beneath the beans.
I thought it was a snake.
These kids are outside, covered in bug juice and sweat, and for some of them, it's the first time they've seen a live skink. In one morning, they harvest about 25 pounds of collard greens, chard, cucumbers, green beans, and zucchini, which they deliver to the Union Mission the next day. There, they learn about the somber realities of hunger in West Virginia. And Tom Tolliver is visibly touched by the response he's received in the last week. His project has gotten a number of calls from people wanting to support his community gardens.
My big thought, my big vision is to rub out hunger through community gardening. And that's my strategy, is to start in Charleston, Kanawha County, West Virginia, America, encouraging people to live off the land.
The vegetables that the YMCA kids harvested and delivered will be served or given away to families in need who come to the Union Mission hungry. Some of these people will not have eaten for days. For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Roxy Todd in Charleston.
Last week, we learned about the Blue Ridge Center for Chinese Medicine in Floyd County, Virginia. When people hear about the center, they sometimes look surprised and ask, what's that doing here? As Robbie Harris from WVTF Public Radio tells us, not only is it serving a local clientele, it's also working to create a network of farmers raising certified traditional Chinese herbs to supply a growing sector in healthcare.
This past March, the Cleveland Clinic opened one of the first hospital-based Chinese herbal therapy clinics in the U.S. to offer patients what it calls a holistic approach to prevention and treatment of chronic disease. It's difficult to get numbers from government health agencies, but studies suggest this may be one of the fastest-growing sectors in medicine, and that means greater demand for one of its main modalities.
So we have an array of herbs coming up, and most of these herbs have been established for the last 7 or 8 years, and so a lot of these will be able to be harvested and divided this year.
David Grimsley and Nate Sloan are pointing out what look like typical peonies growing in a garden at the Blue Ridge Center for Chinese Medicine, but the pedigree makes all the difference.
As long as you could have the paper trail of where they came from and you know that they're a medicinal plant rather than just the cultivar.
Sloan and David Grimsley are directors of a new project here, the Appalachian Medicinal Herb Growers Consortium. They're working to cultivate a network of local farmers to join them.
There's the native populace that's the farming populace, and then there's kind of like a transplant audience as well that has been moving in the last 20 years probably, where it's a little more of a open-minded per se in terms of contemporary beliefs, or how would you phrase that?
Yeah, I feel like the people that move to Floyd County are generally well-traveled, so they've seen a lot of things. They've probably lived in a more metropolitan area. And so having Chinese medicine around isn't a new thing to them at all. Yeah.
But if it's one of the fastest growing areas in medicine, that's partly because the percentage of Americans who use it is still small. To most people, the whole idea of it is foreign. Let's have clinical herbologist Sheila Garangia explain how it works.
So I could have 5 people come to see me with low back pain. 5 people could go to see a Western medicine practitioner for low back pain. And the Western approach is usually like a series of plans, and everybody, regardless, with low back pain will go through that series. So first we try non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and then when those don't work, we try muscle relaxants, and when those don't work, maybe, you know, a cortisone injection or nerve medications like Neurontin or that kind of thing. In Chinese medicine, when we look at the same case, those same 5 people, when we actually look at them more deeply as individual people, we may find that one person has an excessive amount of heat in their system. Another person is excessively cold. Someone else may be very tense in their muscles. Someone else might be very exhausted and weak in their muscles. And the fifth person might have had an injury. In order to arrive at the proper treatment principle, we want to understand that because we want to choose our medicines appropriately for the person, because we may have the same symptom, but we have different people, and we have to treat the person, not the symptom.
Gurangia's practice is in Roanoke. She gets her herbs from trusted sources, but there are only about a dozen in the U.S. Most still come from China, and many in this country are concerned about quality control, pollution, and over-harvesting in China, where medicinal herbs have been growing wild for centuries. She says despite the shortage Chinese medicinal herb growers around the country say is coming, she doesn't want to see it become a large-scale operation here.
In the hands of wise herbal medicine practitioners, we don't need to use huge doses or long, long treatments with herbs. When you pick them correctly, they work very efficiently. They nourish the body back into its own balanced state, and then you move on. So it shouldn't be the case where everybody's needing, you know, gallons and gallons of goji berry juice every day kind of thing, straining the environment even further.
Chinese medicinal herbs grow best in undisturbed land, in forests and meadows, such as you see everywhere in Floyd County and throughout Appalachia. She thinks growing these herbs will help not only her patients, but the region as well.
The species of plants require a certain environment, and by catering to them, we will create that environment. And to some extent, that environment can be healthier than the one we're creating right now.
Jean Giblet is a well-respected Chinese herb grower in upstate New York and a consultant to the Appalachian Medicinal Herb Growers Consortium at the Blue Ridge Center.
The other benefit throughout Appalachia, and actually the Northeast, is that we were never damaged by industrial agriculture to the extent that the Midwest and the Far West have been. So we have many unused old traditional farms that are maybe in hay or pasture, and those can be restored and configured so we could grow herbs on them.
So far, David Grimsley and Nate Sloan have gotten only one local farmer to sign on to grow certified Chinese medicinal herbs, but they say they've got a lot of interest from others around here. A similar project is underway in North Carolina. Meantime, they're like a version of the cooperative extension, going out to area farms offering help if people want to consider joining. No easy feat, because it's not possible to tell what the market is. Insurance does not cover Chinese traditional medicine, so it's hard to track.
And you have to create your reality, you know, and that's sort of the secret in life, and I'm trying to teach my 5-year-old that right now, is you create your reality, and what you put in, you will get back from the universe. And I feel like I've done that, and that's sort of why I'm here.
Grimsley and Sloan will reap their first harvest this fall. They'll collect the seeds and split the perennials to add 3 more gardens next year, growing Chinese medicinal herbs and what they hope becomes a new industry in Appalachia. I'm Robbie Harris.
Next on Inside Appalachia, some thoughts from Appalachian blogger and podcaster Dave Tabler. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. The Appalachian region has long been the focus of fascination and study, going back to the early 1900s when historians and musicologists traveled through the region collecting stories and songs. But folks from outside the region have not always promoted a flattering image, and that, along with a curiosity about his own family, inspired Dave Tabler to start his blog, AppalachianHistory.net. Tabler's family is originally from the eastern panhandle of West Virginia, where he spent a lot of time as a child.
Well, I was born in 1955, so probably until about 1960. I was up there not 100% of the time, but, you know, maybe they'd take me up there for 2 weeks and then come back, and the next month another 3 weeks or that kind of thing. It was a large portion of the time, certainly. What are some of the memories? Well, this is kind of, this is a good question, because this is what leads into why I do this blog. I have memories, for example, in the springtime of, I must have been maybe 3 or 4 years old, I guess, at that time, of grabbing onto my grandfather's trousers and walking behind him in his footsteps as he plowed the garden. I have memories of my grandmother washing my mouth out with lye soap when I, you know, back-talked her. I have memories of friends of theirs sitting around the kitchen table, you know, telling stories about the old days and just, you know, general, you know, picking apples in the fall or whatever it might be. They often would sit out in the summertime in the backyard and sit in a big circle and shuck corn or string beans and that kind of thing. So anyway, I have a lot of very positive memories about Appalachian culture from them. When I graduated from college, I moved to New York City and promptly discovered that not everybody loves Appalachia the way I do. And it just hurt me so much to hear all these ignorant comments. You know, people would say, oh, you have West Virginia background? Well, what kind of toothbrush do you use to brush your tooth? Or, wow, you can't be from there. You have shoes on, or, you know, this sort of stuff. And it just, like, it really kind of rubbed me the wrong way for many years. But, you know, when you're a young person and you're trying to make it in your field, you think, well, I'll just keep my mouth shut and go along to get ahead. But at a certain point, it just spills out, and you have to say, no, this is not the way I want to have my culture viewed, and people have to step up and defend their culture. They can't just, you know, keep their mouths shut.
So at some point, you decided to do something about it in the form of the blog and the podcast.
That's right, and here's what the spark was. When I was about 40, my dad decided that he was going to write a memoir of growing up in West Virginia. And he had never written a book before, even though he's a very educated man. He has a PhD. He'd never written a book before, and so he asked if I would help him edit it, and I said sure. And so we spent about 10 years working on that together until he finally published it. The name of that book is The Day is Far Spent. It's still out there on the market. Anyhow, one of the things that struck me as we were talking about what he wanted to write about was that he refused to talk about either moonshine or hillbillies. And I said, Dad, how can you be from West Virginia and not talk about those things? He said, oh, all that stuff's in the past. And furthermore, nobody wants to hear about that stuff. They all just, you know, if you talk about those things, they're just going to look down on you like you're, you know, a bumpkin, country bumpkin. He said, I don't want people to think about me that way. So, of course, when he finished his book, those questions were still kind of nagging in the back of my mind. I said, well, you know, there's nothing that prevents me from addressing these things on my own, you know, on using a website to do so. And so that's kind of the impetus for what got me started on the blog.
You have different people writing for the blog, and then you write for it, and it what does it cover?
When I started, I was kind of using it more to investigate my own response to, you know, well, what's it like to be a hillbilly, and what about moonshine, and, you know, what's my relationship to all those things. So it was more of a traditional blog. What I started discovering is that I was getting a lot of comments from genealogists and from people who were Appalachian expats who were saying, oh, I just love the fact that you talk about these things. In fact, one of my early listeners or one of my early blog followers was in Alaska, and he said, this is how I keep up with my culture, and, you know, I appreciate that you do this. In more recent years on the blog and on the podcast as well, I've tried to expand it. I bring in a lot of guest posts. What I'm trying to do with both the podcast and the site is to show my listeners and my readers that history is not this dusty old thing that sits up on the shelf.
What's the most surprising thing you've learned doing this work?
I think the most surprising thing to me is how difficult it is for the coal country to move on to the next, whatever the next thing is beyond coal. People are very emotionally invested. You know, if you've had brothers and fathers and uncles and grandfathers who've all worked in the mines, it's really hard to step back from that and say, well, okay, that was good while it lasted, but it's ending. What can we do now? And I think it's really painful to a lot of people in the region. And there's no easy answer. You know, a lot of the infrastructure, the schooling is very, very poor, especially in the, you know, down in southwestern West Virginia and in eastern Kentucky, the school systems are just not really set up to funnel people right into a college education. But I'm very heartened to see that, you know, for example, last fall there was the SOAR initiative that's taking place in eastern Kentucky, and there's just a lot bubbling up from the millennial generation where people are realizing we've got to do the next thing, whatever it is, whether it's tourism or ATV, or, you know, heritage tourism, ecotourism, solar energy, farming, you know, whatever it is that needs to replace coal. But I think we're at this awkward junction where we're neither done with coal, nor are we on to the next thing. And I think that overall has been the big surprise to me of that I didn't see coming.
Do you think that's any different than any other place that is reliant upon a particular industry?
No, that's just a hard reality of how the extractive industries work. And, you know, it didn't even begin with coal. I mean, it was there in the 1880s with timber. If you start, you know, if you look back and do the research on that era, it started back then.
What do you hope people who participate in the blog or read the blog or listen to the podcast, what do you hope people get from your work?
Well, I want people to get a sense of pride in where they're from and who they are and never to have to apologize for being Appalachian or for the way they speak or the music that they listen to or anything else that's associated with Appalachian culture. You know, it's Appalachian culture is American culture. That's something that we've actually forgotten over the years. But, you know, if you ask a non-Appalachian person about Daniel Boone or Davy Crockett, sure, that's American history. But for some reason, we've gotten off track and forgotten that Appalachian history is American history. And that's one of the most important things that I want my listeners to feel is that, you know, we are connected to the mainstream. We influence the mainstream. We're not just a bunch of tumble-down poor people in shacks that can't read or write. And, you know, can you imagine someone doing a history of New York City and they only went to the worst, you know, poverty areas in Harlem and that was all they focused on? People would just laugh or say, that's ridiculous. You know, you forgot about Madison Avenue and Wall Street and this and that. Well, that's kind of how I feel that a lot of the mainstream media views Appalachia. You know, we still are talking about the war on poverty. Well, Christ, that was 50 years ago, people. You know, we've got some of the finest educational institutions in the country. Knoxville has some amazing medical centers. You know, there's just NASCAR and country music are two of the major cultural forces in America today. So there's a lot to be really proud of. And I don't think we have to be cocky about it, and we don't want to push it in people's faces, but we also, you know, we need to take that pride with us wherever we go and just not ever be ashamed to speak up and say, this is who I am, and this is where I'm from.
Well, Dave Tabler, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Tabler estimates each week about 25,000 people visit his website and about 15,000 subscribe to his podcast. Coming up Inside Appalachia, Jessica Lilly takes us to a historic home in Hinton, West Virginia with an interesting past. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Cecilia Mason. Appalachian music master Ralph Stanley is being honored by the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. The Southwest Virginia legend will be honored by the Academy in October in a class that also includes Al Pacino and the man who discovered the Titanic, Robert Ballard. The Massachusetts Academy was founded in 1780 to recognize America's foremost thinkers. Its past members include George Washington and Benjamin Franklin, among many others. Stanley is a Grammy-winning musician and founding father of bluegrass. He's most widely known from the soundtrack of the movie, O Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, death is moving upon my soul. Oh, death. How you treating me? You close my eyes till I can't see.
Eastern Kentucky is working to revitalize its economy through an effort called Shaping Our Appalachian Region, or SOAR. And tourism is one area of focus. As Kentucky Public Radio's John Hingsbergen reports, SOAR held a listening session in Richmond, Kentucky Tuesday on the campus of Eastern Kentucky University.
Lexington Marketing Executive Phil Osborne served as facilitator for the session sponsored by SOAR's Tourism, Arts, and Heritage Work Group. Osborne asked those in attendance to share their ideas about opportunities and challenges for tourism in Eastern Kentucky and the potential for economic development. Alice Jones of EKU's Center for Appalachian Regional Engagement and Stewardship says couples and families visiting the region are going to need a variety of options.
I guarantee you that if we're stuck out at a fishing cabin somewhere, there's at least one steakhouse in your county that's going to get our business one night.
Meeting facilitator Phil Osborne says following the June and July listening sessions, the 10 work groups will review what they heard.
What we'll do at the end of the process is kind of coordinate all of our findings, identify any overlapping opportunities that exist, because that's where those places intersect or where we could probably have the easiest, quickest impact on things. But then, you know, just solicit input from people throughout the region on where they see tourism heading in the next 10, 15, 20 years.
In August, the groups will each identify 3 to 5 priorities as next steps for the SOAR initiative. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm John Hingsbergen.
Historic houses can often draw tourists to an area like eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia, where, in the town of Hinton, a small nonprofit organization is working to restore an old house with an interesting story. Jessica Lilly recently visited the Campbell Flanagan Merle House to find out more.
Dwight Emridge welcomes visitors to the Campbell Flanagan Merle House Museum at 422 Summer Street in Hinton. The house is perched about a block away from the New River, providing a clear view of the water. And so the story goes. Mildred Merle, a descendant of the family, lived in the home and shared the colorful history of her family until her death in 1986. Emridge and a small group of friends saved the house from demolition in 1990.
As a group of local citizens who thought that it was worthwhile to save the oldest house in Hinton, we began our process of trying to keep it running and operating.
With a general store in the basement, the Campbell Flanagan Merle House was built around 1875 by Edgar Campbell and his wife. The family had just moved to Hinton from Virginia.
The old man had a dispute with the next door neighbor on a boundary, a property boundary, and so it's told. I mean, this is history, it's not, that was way back when. And the deal was whoever was found to be in error in that property dispute would leave. They would pack up lock, stock, and barrel and move away. Well, guess what? He lost. So they left their home there.
The Campbells willed the house to their daughter Alice and her husband, John W. Flanagan. During that time, the railroad was just starting to be built. Flanagan was an engineer on the westbound Fast Flying Virginian, a CNO train that wrecked in 1907. Flanagan was trapped and killed after being scalded by steam and hot water from broken pipes. The Flanagan's daughter, Mary, married Robert Merle, hence the final name on the historical museum. Emridge points to a picture of Robert and Mary's daughter, Mildred, as he shows us around.
Of the family, which are on loan from the Merle family. This is Mildred, who was the last person who lived here from the family.
Emridge says the home had fallen into disrepair.
It had aluminum siding on it, which we took off and prepared all the, you know, got all the years of paint off and repainted, and the roof had to be replaced, the wiring had to all be redone. We've got a grant out now to try to put in a small commercial kitchen so that we can host more food-oriented events here, possibly.
The home is filled with pictures, antique toys, and even an original bed frame from the home. Emrich sits and plays a ragtime song on the donated player piano. Like the house, he's hoping to have the piano restored.
We're just trying to recreate the history so that, you know, kids would see what it was like to live way back when and how it's different from now.
For West Virginia Public Radio, I'm Jessica Lilly in Hinton.
Thank you.
We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from Moorhead State Public Radio in Moorhead, Kentucky, WMMT in Whitesburg, Kentucky, WEKU in Richmond, Kentucky, WETS in Johnson City, Tennessee, Allegheny Mountain Radio in Dunmore, West Virginia, WVTF in Southwestern Virginia, the Allegheny Front, and Kentucky Public Radio. Our opening theme music is by Michael Lipton. Our closing theme music is by Al Pettaway and Amy White from their CD, Land of the Sky, from Maggie's Music. We'd love to hear from you. You can email us at feedback@wvpublic.org. You can also address your letters to Inside Appalachia, in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, West Virginia, 25301. The Inside Appalachia podcast is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and at wvpublic.org. I'm Cecilia Mason. Inside Appalachia is a news and public affairs production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.